450 foot-pounds of torque forward. He had two wheels pushing, I had four. It was time the young men had a lesson in physics. Slowly and achingly, I drove him back at an angle. He slammed on the brakes, but I already had him moving, and there was little chance that with my extra weight I was going to be stopped. The driver's side rear wheel was the first to go off, and I have to admit that I found the looks on the faces of the boys who were standing pretty amusing. I kept the pressure on and watched as they leaped from the truck onto the surface of the bridge. The Chevrolet kept going backward. There was a pretty heated conversation going on between the two in the cab, especially when the driver's side front wheel also went over the edge. I kept pushing, and the Chevy looked as though it was just getting to the point where I thought it might go over and fall on its side into the shallow creek 4 feet below. The conversation had reached the screaming teenager stage when the mouthy passenger started making moves to open the door and climb out. It was then that I heard someone walking over the top of my truck and watched as a pair of moccasined feet stepped down onto the cowl and strode across the hood. The Cheyenne Nation placed a hand on the grill guard and then lightly leveraged himself onto the wide wooden planks of the bridge. I let off the accelerator and watched as he made it to the door of the tipping truck before the kid could get it open. The two who had abandoned ship were standing a little ways away, still holding their weapons, but unsure as to how to proceed. One started to take a step forward, but then thought better of it. The mouthy passenger made the mistake of shoving his pistol toward the bear, but he simply snatched it out of the kid's hand and casually tossed it into the water. I could see the veins in the young man's neck as he screamed at Henry, but the bear just stood there looking at him. After a moment, the teen had to pause to catch his breath, and Henry took the opportunity to say something which caused the driver to join the high-volume vitriol. The Cheyenne Nation turned to look at Vic and me, shrugged his shoulders, and then casually, almost dismissively, reached down and grabbed the rocker panel in both hands. I don't know how much weight it was or how much effort it took, but the Chevy rose in his grip, jerked once, and then gracefully tipped over the side, landing in the mud with a tremendous splash. The near wheels were only a few feet from the bridge, and the dry side of the USS C-10 was a couple of feet higher than the wooden surface. The two still in the truck were scrambling to get out the passenger side window as Vic and I joined Henry in surveying the damage. "I thought you were trying to save them," he sighed. "Me too." The passengers' legs and feet were wet, but the driver was soaked as their truck bucked a few times and then died in its watery grave. The passenger, who on closer inspection might have been Hispanic, was, of course, the first to speak. "You're going to have to pay for that." I glanced at the pair who had been in the bed and who were still standing at the far end of the bridge and watched as Vic, with her sidearm hanging in her hand, turned to face them. I swiveled my gaze back to the two U-boat commanders. "I doubt it." The driver whined. "You pushed us off the bridge." I threw a thumb at the Cheyenne Nation. "Actually, he did." The passenger was back at it. "Well, somebody's going to have to..." I held up a finger. "You know, back when I was doing my initial training at the Law Enforcement Academy in Douglas, Wyoming, long before either one of you were born, one of the first things a crusty old instructor taught me about dealing with the public, and that would be you, is that we can argue as long as you'd like, and then I win." They didn't seem to know what to say to that, so I continued. "If you keep running your mouths, I'm going to haul the bunch of you down to Belfouche and throw you in jail for interfering with a law enforcement official and his sworn duties, let alone brandishing weapons in an unlawful manner." I could feel Vic looking at the side of my face. She loved it when I made up laws. And I could almost hear her wondering if there was a way to brandish weapons in a lawful manner. I let the dust on that one settle before sticking my hand out. "Would you like some assistance in exiting the vehicle?" The passenger spit in the distance between us. "We don't need no help from you." I shrugged and gave the cadre of gunmen at the end of the bridge a hard look and then started back toward my truck with the Cheyenne Nation and my undersheriff in tow as the driver called after us, "Hey, could you give us a ride?" I stopped and looked at Henry and Vic and then back to the kid. "Where?" There wasn't much room with all four of them in the cab with us, but at least I'd made them give up all their weapons, which were now in the toolbox in the bed of the bullet. The bear had his arms draped over the shoulders of the kids in the back seat, which included the driver of the pickup. The passenger who had brandished the pistol was seated between Vic and me, and I had to admit that I found it pretty humorous that the mouthy one, who seemed indifferent to all the trappings of authority, was completely buffaloed by my very attractive deputy. We'd been driving for 10 minutes, and I wasn't sure he'd made eye contact with her yet. She propped an elbow on the armrest and supported her chin in the web of her hand as she looked at him, and I could actually feel him crowding me in the seat in an attempt to put some distance between the two of them. I cleared my throat and decided to throw the kid a lifeline. "So, what's your name?" He cleared his throat. "Edmund?" He glanced at Vic.
"Eddie."
"Eddie what?" I asked, half expecting him to say Lanier.
"Lanier?"
There was a chuckle from the back, but I wasn't quick enough in the rearview mirror to see who had thought that was funny. "And what are the names of the rest of your merry men?"
"Well, that's my older brother, the one that was driving the truck before it went in the creek. His name is Edgar Lanier."
To my trained eye, they didn't look anything alike. "The two of you are brothers?" He shrugged with one shoulder.
"Well, more like half-brothers."
"I see." He turned. "The other one in that corner is Merrill Lanier, and this one on this side is Joe." Joe even went so far as to produce a hand on my shoulder, which I shook. "You're a Lanier, too?" He nodded. Eddie stayed turned in the seat, and I could guess who he was looking at. Evidently, 6.5-foot-tall Cheyenne warriors were safer to gaze upon than 5.5-foot Italian deputies who filled out their uniform shirts in interesting ways.
"Are you a real Indian?"
Henry waited a moment and then replied, "Honest Injun." He extended a hand to him. "I am Henry Standing Bear, Bear Society Dog Soldier Clan."
Eddie shook his hand. "Wow."
Joe asked the next question. "Are you under arrest too?" Vic laughed, and Henry's voice took on a gentler tone. "No, the sheriff is a friend of mine." Eddie turned to look at me.
"You're not the sheriff. We've met him, and he's got a great big beard."
"I'm a different sheriff from another county, another state." I paused a moment. "Didn't you guys read the emblems on my truck?" There was no response, and a depressing thought crossed my mind. "You fellas mind if I ask you a question?" Nobody voiced an objection, so I continued. "It's a school day. How come none of you are in class?"
"We don't go to school no more."
I glanced around at them. They looked about Cord's age.
"None of you?"
Eddie, obviously the spokesman of the group, shook his head.
"Nope, we all graduated, and now we're the First Order, guaranteed seats in the Celestial Kingdom."
He looked out the window and went into a now familiar auto-speak. "We guard the perimeter of the Apostolic Church of the Lamb of God, keeping the faithful safe, the shepherd unto his sheep."
"Baa!"
He turned, and for the first time made eye contact with Vic, the one emitting animal noises.
"Are you an unbeliever?"
Vic sighed.
"Don't fuck with me, kid. I'm a recovering Catholic, and we owned most of the known world when your bunch started promising people planets and wearing funny underwear."
Thankfully, Eddie interrupted the theological debate by raising his hand and pointing to a T in the road just beyond a plastic-flowered cross, the kind that marks vehicle fatalities. I'd seen enough of those, especially on the highways to the res, to last me into eternity. At the other side of the turnoff there was a girl, looking fragile and unprotected, in a homemade prairie dress and bonnet, who was sitting behind a card table with what looked to be baked goods.
"You take a right here."
Thinking it had been quite a while since I'd had some homemade baked goods, I slowed the truck. The kid must have misunderstood my change of speed.
You can just drop us off here."
I looked down the rutted dirt road and could see that it stretched to the horizon.
"That's okay. I think I'd like to make sure we get you all the way home."
"There'll be trouble."
I swiveled my head to look at him.
"For whom?"
He glanced around at his buddies.
"For us. They're not going to be happy about us wrecking the truck, getting our guns taken away, or bringing you to the inner circle."
Vic raised an eyebrow.
"What, you're going to lose your celestial folding chair and have to stand for all eternity?"
I didn't give him a chance to respond.
"What happens if we drop you off here?"
"We walk back, or we'll catch a ride if somebody comes along."
"The gist being that you'll have your weapons and won't have introduced us to the inner sanctum."
Henry's voice rumbled from the back.
2 out of 3.
Eddie nodded, and then looked at his lap. On one condition, he looked at me. If you answer a few questions, then I'll let you out here, but you have to answer them, and you have to be truthful. I eased the truck to the side of the dirt road, across from the baked goods table. And I'll warn you that I'm an expert in knowing when people are lying to me. He turned in the seat, glanced at the others, and then nodded. Okay. Have any of you ever heard of a woman in your group by the name of Sarah Tisdale? No one said anything. A blonde woman with blue eyes, roughly 30 years of age. I pulled the school picture that Eleanor had given me at the bar from my shirt pocket and held it up for them to see. She would be about 17 years older than this photo. Still nothing. I pulled the truck's gear selector down. Wait! The voice had come from the back, and I turned and looked at one of the boys, the driver and Eddie's half-brother, Edgar. I held the photo out for him to see. You know her? He glanced at the others, and Eddie was quick to speak. Shut up! I started turning the wheel to pull us back onto the road.
Not Tisdale.
I stopped and turned to Edgar after giving Eddie a strong look. She may have another name?
Lanier.
I rested my face in a hand. Of course, it had to be. I waited a moment and then opened the door and climbed out.
Edgar, why don't you and I take a walk?
Walking around the back of the Bullet, I waved at the girl at the table, who looked to be maybe 10. Henry and Vic had allowed Edgar to get out of the truck and now corralled the rest of the boys by the grill guard. Steering the skinny youth to the side of the road a little away from both the Bullet and the girl, we pulled up at the Floral Cross, victims of our upbringings and unwilling to walk on the symbolic grave. Do you know where she is?
No, sir.
He paused and looked over at the others.
She was cast out.
From the Apostolic Church of the Lamb of God?
Yes, sir.
I brought my face up from the marker and turned to look at him. I still couldn't see any family resemblance between him and his half-brother.
When?
He shrugged his shoulder.
About a month ago?
That would have coincided with her appearance at the Butte County Sheriff's Department when she'd been looking for her runaway child.
Why did she get kicked out?
Because of her son.
Cord?
Yes, sir.
I studied the Floral Cross, adorned with blue plastic lilies and chrysanthemums.
Was he kicked out, too?
Yes, sir.
Why?
He was found wanting. I was getting tired of the coded church speak.
What does that mean?
He wasn't selected as one of the three sons of the One Mighty and Strong. I sighed.
And who is that?
Roy Lanier.
I massaged the bridge of my nose, attempting to rid myself of the headache that was trying to grow roots there, and thought about the domineering and obese man I'd met the other night in the back of the fancy pickup.
So Sarah Tisdale was married to Roy Lanier?
Yes, sir.
He paused for a moment and then lowered his voice.
Cord is in line for the inheritance of the mantle of celestial supremacy in the Lord's true church, but committed apostasy and turned away.
I knew there was a reason I liked the kid. Here he was attempting to get out of this loony bin, and his mother was excommunicated for looking for him. What a world. I studied the teen in front of me and thought about all the good that religion could do and all the bad. You mind if I ask you another question?
Nope.
If all of you are related, then why do none of you look alike? He glanced around, embarrassed.
We are lost boys.
We're kicked out of the communities in Hilldale, Utah, Colorado City, Arizona, and El Dorado, Texas. Mr. Lanier adopted us and gave us a place to be.
Somehow that was a notch in Roy Lanier's favor, but I still wasn't convinced.
My reveries were suspended as he looked down the road at a spiraling dust cloud that approached from the straight-as-an-arrow distance to the horizon.
Oh, no.
I followed his gaze. Somebody you know? I walked the boy back to the truck and joined the small group at the grill guard.
Henry, never one to miss anything from near or far,
was looking down the road and called out to me,
"We have company."
Hmm. I thought I'd left the others as I walked across the dirt road to where the young girl sat in the chair by the card table, but when I got there I noticed that Edgar had followed me. I studied the array, which was indeed full of plastic bags of cookies, cakes, and an amazing assortment of pies. The young girl looked up at me from under the shade of the bonnet, where I could see her mongoloid features. Her face looked like a full moon in a night sky. When she noticed the young man standing beside me, her voice was an excited croak. "Hello, Edgar." "Hi, sis." She was already up and around the table when he closed his arms around her and ushered her back to her chair. "Have you been out here all day?" She clutched his hand and answered, her voice breaking, All day. When she turned to me, I could see that her lips were chapped, and when I glanced around, I couldn't see a blanket, a cooler, a bottle of water, or anything with which the child might have been supplied. "Would you like to buy some cookies?" A tide of emotions attempted to draw me under as I was reminded of Melissa Littlebird, a young woman I knew, a victim of fetal alcohol syndrome, and the daughter of Lonnie Littlebird, the chief of the Northern Cheyenne. Yes, I would. She recited the prices of the individual items in a long list and then smiled up at me, her rounded cheeks almost completely hiding her eyes. I dug my wallet from my back pocket. "Are you thirsty?" She thought about it and then looked at Edgar for approval. The young man smiled and nodded. "You can answer for yourself." She looked back at me. "Yes?" I motioned to the bear, who was still standing in the center of the road. "Hey, Henry, could you grab me one of those pops from a little cooler under the back seat?" He did as I asked, still keeping an eye on the approaching vehicle, and then tossed the Coke across the road to me. I stuffed my wallet under my arm and caught the can, tapped the top in order to disseminate the carbonation, and then gently pulled the tab and handed it to her. She looked at the pop and then to Edgar. The young man glanced away and then up to me. "We're not supposed to have soft drinks." I motioned toward the Coke in the girl's hands, now noticing that she had no fingernails. "I think in this case that you shouldn't worry about it." He smiled and gestured for her to drink, which she did. I have relished numerous beverages in my life. From the Rainier beer I discovered in my teens and still drank, the Tiger beer I slugged to support my sweat habit in Vietnam, to the Pappy Van Winkle's 23-year-old family reserve I drank from the bottle hidden in the corner cabinet of my old boss, Lucian Connolly. But I'm sure that I've never enjoyed a sip of anything as much as that girl enjoyed her first taste of Coca-Cola.
"It makes my nose tickle."
Her brother and I smiled at her, but the young man's face sobered at the arrival of a late-model maroon Suburban with tinted windows. We both watched as the dust from the vehicle blew past us and down the road like an ill omen. I watched as four men got out of the SUV and stood by the doors, their attention divided between Henry, who was still standing in the middle of the road in front of them, Vic, with the other boys at the side of my truck, and the three of us at the bake sale table. The man who got out of the passenger side was tall, with a dark suit and with hair in a reddish pompadour that swept up the sides of his head and around his enormous ears. The driver was darker, bigger, older, bearded, and heavy-set, in a dress shirt with a straw cowboy hat that looked like white plastic, out of season. I stood there with my wallet in my hands and waited. One of the other men was middle-aged in a black polo shirt. He had exited from the driver's side back seat and was careful to keep an eye on the Absaroka County Undersheriff and Henry Standing Bear of the Bear Society Dog Soldier Clan, still standing in the middle of the road. The one with the hair and the one in the plastic hat ignored Henry and started toward me along with the fourth man, who was also in a black polo shirt and chinos. Unless I was mistaken, he was the muscle. The tall, red-headed man was the first to talk, and he did it slowly, as if it tired him to speak with mere mortals, and so that, with our limited faculties, we would be able to understand and obey. "Hello, I'm Ronald Lanier. Is there some sort of trouble?" I waited until they were next to me, keeping
keeping my head in my wallet, pretending to count out bills, as I kept my attention on young Edgar and his sister. "Nope, just buying some bait goods." Lanier glanced across the street at the stars on my doors, making a point of looking around the Cheyenne Nation, who now stood facing us with his muscled arms folded across his chest. Ronald put out his hand, feminine with long fingers and manicured nails, in an attempt to press down my wallet. "There's no need for that. I'm sure we'll be happy to make a donation to the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department." He left his hand on mine until I looked up at him. "No need." He shot a look at the huge man beside him and stuffed both hands in his pants pockets. "This is my friend and spiritual advisor, Earl Gloss." I glanced toward the bear, still standing in the road with a slight smile on his face. "That's mine." Ronald Lanier waved at Henry and then turned back to me. "He's Native American?" "Northern Cheyenne, to be exact." He nodded and called out, "We will look forward to Lamanite assistance in the apocalyptic wars to come with the dark-skinned children of Satan." Henry's grin broadened, and his voice, even though it was low, carried in the wind like a scythe. "I would not count on it." Lanier's eyes hardened a little, but he disguised it by turning back to me. "Where exactly is Absaroka County, if you don't mind my asking, Sheriff?"
"Wyoming."
"Oh, and what brings you to our fair state?" He gestured toward the table and the two young people still standing in his presence. "Besides the baked goods, I'm looking for a woman." He didn't look surprised. "And how can I help you?" "Her name is Sarah Tisdale, and I have reason to believe that she's a member of your group." He turned to confer with the older man. "Earl, have we heard of this woman?" Gloss was quick to speak up.
"Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Lanier."
I gave the two of them a nice long stare. Strange, because she made inquiries at the Butte County Sheriff's Office concerning her child, Cord. I don't suppose you've heard of that person, either. Lanier turned again, and I was starting to get the impression that he was a pirate talking to the parrot on his shoulder. "Earl?" The bearded man shook his head. "No, never heard of him." I stared at Gloss. "Funny. I didn't say anything about it being a him." He looked past me at Edgar, who still stood by his sister, now clutching the can of pop to her chest, both of them still keeping their eyes to the ground.
"Edgar, where have you been, and where's your truck?"
I interrupted. "There's been an accident. No one was hurt, but their truck was dumped in a creek bed up near one of your gun towers." It was his turn to pause and then emphasize, "Observation towers." I glanced at Edgar, still studying the few sprigs of grass at his feet, and then turned back to Ronald Lanier. "And what is it you're observing?"
"The Lord rewards those who are prepared."
"I'm afraid I ran the boys off the bridge, but I'll be happy to pay for the damages. We were just giving them a ride home."
"I'm sure that also will be unnecessary, Sheriff."
I kept my eyes on him, but spoke loudly enough for them all to hear. "I am an honest man, Mr. Lanier, and pay for my mistakes. Besides, we've got the room for the children, and I'd kind of like to get a look at your place."
"We're private people, Sheriff. I'm sure you'll understand if we don't offer you an invitation."
He gestured for Gloss to retrieve the children, and legally there was little I could do, and he knew it. The big guy, bumping my shoulder as a parting shot, smirked as he went around me, but then made a tactical mistake by pushing his luck just a touch too far. He shoved Edgar toward his so-called father and then reached down and viciously slapped the can of soda from the girl's hands.
"We don't allow our children to drink such trash."
Henry said later that the man might have fared better if he'd had any idea what it was that was about to happen next. The bear said he might have even been able to stay on his feet, but I doubt it. As it happened, when my clenched fist struck the side of his head and sent him reeling into the ditch, he slapped against the ground like a pole-axed steer. The Cheyenne Nation, always aware of what I was going to do before I did it,
had already stepped out to block the other backseater, and I could see that Vic had unsnapped the safety strap on her 9mm and was looking eye to eye with one of the polo shirts before he turned to study me. The scouring of wingtips grazed the inside of my lungs, and the coolness overtook my face as my hands grew still. I faced the two remaining men with my knuckles resting on the card table and thought about how Edgar's sister had been sitting out here all day without supplies and how she was likely to be left behind until there was nothing more to sell. I haven't bought my baked goods. Chapter 6. One of the best ways I have discovered to get back in the good graces of your staff is to show up with a couple of boxloads of desserts and deposit them in the communal area near Ruby's desk. I had done so and was now brooding in my office over a tepid cup of coffee that resided in my old-school Denver Broncos mug with the chip on the rim. It was resting on a couple of magazines, and my forearm was lying flat on the desk with my chin propped on it as I slowly turned the mug by the handle and studied the chip, stained and grimy-looking, from coffee residue.
"You could get a new one."
I continued staring at my sole piece of office drinkware.
"I don't want a new one."
The Cheyenne Nation leaned in my doorway, drinking a mugful himself.
"Then what do you want?"
He noticed the magazine under my arm.
"Do you mind if I ask why you have the 1972 January edition of Playboy magazine on your desk?"
"I'm thinking of taking up airbrushing." I waited a moment and then asked a favor. "Hey, do you think you could take Mr. Rockwell out for a walk long enough for me to talk to Cord about his mother?"
"Yes."
He waited and watched me continue to contemplate my mug a while before asking,
"Are you depressed because you missed chess with Lucian last night?"
"No."
"Are you depressed because the Durant Dogies are retiring your number?"
"No." He nudged his sizable shoulder off the door jamb and loitered.
"Are you mad at yourself for that roundhouse punch that planted that farmer like seed corn?"
I thought about it. "I suppose."
"Some seeds need planting."
"It's not going to make that boy and his sister's lives any easier." He sipped his coffee.
"How do you know that?" "It's possible that now that he has been manhandled, he is less likely to manhandle."
"That's not how it works, and you know it." He considered his own mug, which obviously belonged to Vic, and read in bold script, "From Philly and fucking proud of it."
"You could arrest them."
"Tim Berg could arrest them."
"Yes."
I rose up and leaned back in my chair, hooking my foot under my desk again in an attempt to not imitate Buster Keaton. I listened to the geese honking and glanced out the window in time to see the tail end of a large V-pattern headed due south. His smile lingered.
"They are complex, those chambers of the human heart."
"Yep, they are." Henry stood there for a while, both of us saying nothing.
"You do realize that it is simply a myogenic muscular organ, right?"
I sighed and stood, leaving the copy of Playboy on my desk, but folding and stuffing the gun magazine underneath in my back pocket. "I know it can carry a lot of weight." The bear followed as I walked out of my lair and into the Turkish bazaar that had become my sheriff's office. From somewhere, Ruby had procured paper plates and plastic utensils, and even a triangular spatula that she was now using to divide up a pecan pie. "How are the goods?" The newly returned Cesar Vittoria and Vic were sharing a bag of cookies and were seated on the bench beside the stairs. The Basco was excited. "We should go back and buy more."
"I bought them out."
I turned to Ruby. "Need I ask where our two lodgers are?" She glanced at the old Seth Thomas on the wall above the stairwell. "Well, it's 8:43, and I'd say they are downstairs, watching the 8:43 showing of My Friend Flicka."
"As opposed to the 7:13 or the 10:03 presentation?"
"Exactly." When Henry, Vic, Sancho, and I arrived at the base of the steps, the pair were still transfixed by the television on the rolling cart. I thanked the lucky star in my chest that Freimeyer had been able to find a dual-deck player that accommodated both DVDs and VHS tapes. A lot of our certification and training classes were still on videotapes, which I tried hard not to think about. How's the horse? We timed our entrance pretty well, in that the end credit music was swelling, and the two looked over at us. Rockwell stood, the way he always did when Vic entered the room, to her unending puzzlement. It is interesting that the story only changes in small ways each time the machine tells it. I think you'll find it's exactly the same. The old man disagreed. No, subtle but definitely different. Uh-huh. I made my way into the briefing room, pulled out one of the chairs, and sat. Vic and Santiago followed my lead, but Henry remained at the base of the steps. Rockwell studied the Cheyenne Nation. You have a savage with you. I glanced over my shoulder. Actually, he's the most civilized of all of us. Henry made a show of waving at the crazy person. I was hoping that you might take a walk with him while I have a chat with Cord. Rockwell, probably weighing his odds, studied the bear. Where would we be going? The Cheyenne Nation spoke from the stairs.
Just down the block.
The man of God, Son of Thunder, stood, gathered his coat from the chair beside him, and for the first time I noticed that he walked with a slight limp.